Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 5th of June 2016. My name is TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Nick from Partially Obstructed View and Julie Raby. We're now going to talk about Monster Raving Loony, which is a new play by James Graham, which has been touring around since February this year, starting off with, I think, at the Theatre Royal Plymouth, and has finally come into the Soho Theatre for a run in London. It's directed by Simon Stokes and has a cast of Joseph Alacy, Joanna Brooks, Jack Brown, Samuel James, Vivian Achipong, and Tom Atwood. It's a biographical play based on the life of David Such, better known sometimes as Screaming Lord Such, a man who I think brightened elections up for about 30 years almost. And he was a man who would always stand against the sitting Prime Minister at general elections and would often stand at by-elections, really promoting a party of silliness. The Monster Raving Loony Party that he founded wasn't founded until the 1980s, but he first stood in an election in 1963, I think. His take was always, you know, be silly, have a bit of fun. But oddly enough, some of the things that they proposed came true. We have things like pet passports, oddly enough, and lowering the voting age to 18 from 21, which he pioneered in the early days. Both of those came true. The way that they tell this story of David Such is to put him inside a lot of sketches of various comedic forms. We perhaps start off with things like pantomime, you get a bit of George Formby, and you go on through things like The Goons, Pete and Dud, Hancock, Till Death Us Do Part, Heidi High, Blackadder, and Allo Allo. And you have these sketches to play around with as they're telling his life, and actually sometimes, you know, you're telling his life within these sketches where the actors are putting on personas of these fairly well-known sketches, although I think some of them would be rather obscure, and I think it does help to know your comedy a bit to get the understanding of this. The central performance by Samuel James as David Such is very charming and somewhat tragic. There's especially when you get the Steptoe and Son, which is, Steptoe and Son is always loaded with pathos, and there's a Steptoe and Son piece in here which is just as loaded as with pathos. This is a man at the end of the day who is living in a house full of bric-a-brac with his mother, and not to give too much away, commits suicide less than a year after his mother dies. And it does portray the Screaming Lord Such as a bit of a tragic figure, and to me, he was always quite a bit of fun, and there's just a little bit of common sense in there. And I felt that although I enjoyed this play and liked to see David Such portrayed in a funny way, there's lots of humour and fun in this play, I did rather feel that it kind of underplays him. I mean, the thing he is known for is that he lost more elections, I think it's 49 elections, more elections than anybody else in history. Well, yeah, but he wasn't trying to win. He was perhaps trying to self-promote, but also just pointing out the ridiculousness of politicians, which is always a good thing, I think. I think this is really well performed, this play, not just Samuel James. You've got the rest of the cast who are playing their own instruments, singing, getting entire audience to take part in the skiffle song, and interacting in other ways like that. There's a rather funny bingo scene at one point. So it's a lot of fun, apart from this, in the end, rather tragic story, I think. But I think it's extremely well done. I did have a few complaints. I am a little bit of a comedy nerd, so if the scene is set in, say, the late 70s and they're doing a sitcom from the early 1980s, I'm going to have a slight problem with that. And there were one or two things where you're saying, yeah, but that particular series wasn't on then, or they weren't making that kind of joke at that point. And there's a sort of one or two mismatches like that. And I think some of the Pete and Dud stuff in one of the sitcoms was out of place, and I think if you really know your comedy, it's going to jar slightly, which we won't if you just know enough comedy to get all the references. But then again, if you don't get the references, you might not enjoy this play at all. The other slight thing is that they do a lot of stuff with video, but you often miss the video because all the video screens at the Soho Theatre are on the periphery of the stage, and they're right at the sides. So something is interesting is happening on stage, but there's also something interesting happening on the screens. You miss it completely because you're concentrating on the stage and not on the screen, and perhaps you should have been concentrating on the screen at the time because it would have been giving you useful extra information. And another thing is that Screaming All Such, when he wasn't standing unsuccessfully for elections, was a mid-range musician. He had a band, would actually pay for his electoral campaigns by having concerts and raising money that way. And he was in the early days quite associated with Joe Meek, and I would have liked to have seen something about that in this, but that's asking an awful lot, and I don't think it really has too much relevance to the rest of the play, but it would have been nice to have a little nod towards that, because it's certainly they worked together because Lord Such got Joe Meek and vice versa. They understood each other from a, well, artistic point of view, I suppose you could say. Overall, this is very enjoyable. This is James Graham showing us how good a playwright he is yet again. There is some additional guest direction here from Cal McChrystal, who is somebody who came in and apparently upped the joke quotient and made the slapstick a bit sharper. And it is a very sharp and funny play when it isn't being rather sad and tragic. So it's a nice mixture of this, the comic and the tragic. And we are looking forward to James Graham's coming back in with his play This House, which is coming back, I think, coming back into the West End in a few weeks or months. What do you think about this, Nick?
This was one of my favourite things I've seen all year so far. I obviously don't know the precise dates of every comedy that was used on this, but I'm still impressed by the fact that the broad sweeps of it goes in chronological order, maybe not strictly accurately, but that he manages to match. I mean, he could have done it in completely random order. Obviously, he could have just, you know, mixed up the order in which the comedy references came in. But it is largely in the style of the time that he's talking about, of the point we've got to in the biography. So the fact that maybe it's a few years out in some places really didn't bother me, because I think it's such a clever achievement. And I think this is the thing for me. It's not often you find a show that you can kind of at the same time appreciate on a couple of different levels. But I really enjoyed the comedy. I really enjoyed the performances. I was at the same time sort of sitting back and just being really impressed by the technical skill of the writing, of the way that he's used the kind of the sketch format, and the fact that every couple of minutes everybody is playing their characters in a completely different style, and yet you've got a coherent biography coming out of there. Maybe not a complete biography, but I certainly feel as if I know more about Screaming Lord Such than I did before, because obviously he's someone who I knew as a bloke in the background of elections, all kind of dressed up in his leopard skin. And of course there was kind of a little reference to him in the original Blackadder in the third series. There's a character who's obviously a take on him, so Blackadder obviously had to show up as one of the stories that were used to tell his story. And I just very, very impressed. I think almost all of Samuel James's impressions are just spot on. And I think the only one that was a bit generic was his Alan Partridge. The other one who's very, very good is Joanna Brooks. She's got a hell of a lot of different characters coming out absolutely accurately. I agree that, you know, you have to know a certain amount of the references. But then maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I was watching this and thinking, well, this would never go to America. But then you'd think that the play what I wrote a few years back became, you know, big on Broadway, and that was a Morecambe and Wise tribute, and nobody there had ever heard of them. So, you know, I don't know what works where, to be honest. It's all a bit random what's going to work where. But I would suspect this is very much a British thing, and maybe also a certain age, because you kind of need to have, I mean, obviously a lot of this is before I was born, the early scenes, but I think there is obviously some element of seeing things that you grow up with and the comedy that you grow up with. So I think if you're born after David Such died, there's not really anything you're going to see that you grew up with except for in repeats. But anyone who was alive during his lifetime is going to find something to find very familiar. So yeah, this was a big hit for me. I really enjoyed it, and the really strong performances, and just a really clever piece.
We're now going to talk about A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Globe Theatre. This is the first play directed by new artistic director of Shakespeare's Globe, Emma Rice. She has made one or two changes to the theatre which people might not like, which is to install a lot more lighting than there usually is and much more professional looking rigs. And also there's quite a lot of amplification in this production. I'm not sure it's going to go across all productions. Some people might say that it turns it into yet another outdoor performance area rather than the Globe, which might be seen as rather special. She has cooperated with dramaturg Tanika Gupta to give a few slightly interesting changes to this play, The Athenians Become Hoxton Hipsters. The play stars, amongst others, I'll just pick some out, Meow Meow, who was in Nihai's version of Umbrellas of Cherbourg a few years back. She plays Hippolyta and Titania. We have Zubin Vala as Theseus and Oberon. Ankur Bahi plays Helenus, a male version of Helena. Nakuti Gathra plays Demetrius. Edmund Derrington plays Lysander. Anjana Vasan plays Hermia. And we have Ewan Wadrop playing Bottom. Nick, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
I had kind of mixed feelings about the production. I think I certainly don't feel about it the way that some people have, that it's kind of a sign that that's it, that the Globe's dead and Emma Rice's run's going to be a disaster. And this is despite the fact that I'm coming into this having mostly not liked Emma Rice's work in the past. I think the absolute nadir was her version of Steptoe and Son, which opted to completely kill any hint of comedy in that. But, you know, it's a new space and it's somebody who, you know, by her own admission, is not the most kind of well-versed in Shakespeare. I think she's only done before this one heavily edited production of Shakespeare. So she's someone who kind of came in with an idea of using it, you know, experimenting and kind of learning as she goes along. So that's the template that she got the job under. So I think this does feel like an experiment in how to use the space. And, you know, as such, I think there's some things that really work, some things that don't. I can't really comment on the lighting because I was at a matinee, so I could tell that it was there. I could tell there were times when there was kind of coloured filters on everything, but looking at the production pictures, it's clearly been designed with the evening performances in mind, and I had quite a sunny afternoon, so I can't really comment on that. I wasn't hugely a fan of the miking. It's nothing to do with how you should use the Globe. I assume that everybody was mic'd up because there was such a huge use of music. It was kind of almost constant. I think in a way that a few years ago the Globe did with a production of Merry Wives of Windsor, that also had a deliberate attempt to use the music like a film score. And I think that's a bit how this uses the music, although in this case it's sort of an Indian-inspired music. So I think that might be why everybody's mic'd up, because it's certainly not a space I've often found any problem with projection. The reason I don't particularly like it in there is I think, you know, miking works fine in an end-on stage or a very shallow thrust like the Olivier, where it's, you know, been being used for years, because you're basically looking in one direction all the time. I think stages like this, where the actual stage area could be anywhere in the whole place, I don't think it works quite as well, because I think people are showing up out of any entrance and the back of the groundlings and up on the balconies. And I think the people's voices are a way of knowing where to look and knowing who's talking at any given time. And, you know, with miking up, you do notice, obviously, after a while that all the sound is coming from one place, which is the speakers. So you're not really getting that element of being able to see who's speaking, especially it is a place where you could often end up with someone behind a column for a whole scene. So it does help to have little clues as to where you're supposed to be looking. So that for me wasn't a hit, but not particularly, I think, for the reasons that people have said. Because I've also disliked people being mic'd up in other kind of spaces where it's not kind of a pros arch or any kind of end-on stage where you kind of need a bit more of a clue of where to look. So basically, I can't comment on the lighting, and for different reasons, the sound wasn't a hit for me. But I'm all for using the space in different ways, because I liked a lot of Dominic Drongaul's stuff, but I think there was a bit too much of a tendency. And I don't never want to see something done in Elizabethan or Jacobean dress again. I think that's definitely a major part of what the venue is and its kind of unique atmosphere, but I don't think it's necessarily what everything there should be. So I think if we're going to get a bit more of the stuff here that goes in a bit of a kind of a different direction and gives directors a bit more scope to be playful and reinvent the play, I think that's a good thing. Because I think at the end of the day, the thing that works about the Globe is the atmosphere and the way it's built and, you know, the shape of the thing. And I don't think that's reliant on not using any technology. So, you know, I think there's a lot about that venue that is specific to the venue and not to the time that it's emulating. So I don't think necessarily you're going to lose its identity by doing things like this. Having said that, the set design I had a bit of an issue with, because there's these huge balloons covering over the open roof, and that's fine, but it's these kind of clear but not entirely clear pillars that are also floating all around above the ground wings, and they did get in my line of vision quite a lot, which is not really something you need in a place that already has a lot of pillars and a lot of obstructed views. Having said that, I think there was a lot in the production that was very interesting, and that, you know, I think what did work very well that I was very worried about was the rewriting, because there had been kind of mentions of kind of rewriting, and I got horrible images of, you know, the notorious rewrites that Julian Fellowes did for Romeo and Juliet, where he just kind of went, oh, well, that's a bit too difficult for stupid people, I'll rewrite that for them. But that's not really what's going on here. I think there's a few references that are dated and are just not funny anymore. They're gone and replaced by something a bit more topical. I think there's nothing really, and it's not, to be honest, overwhelming. It's not like the whole play feels rewritten. It's just the odd lines. I mean, as you say, changing the Athenians to Hoxton hipsters, although given how far they went for, you know, how much that gag reappears, I would have thought that would have actually been reflected in the character design, and I don't think either Lysandra or Demetrius look particularly hipsterish. They, you know, they just look kind of middle class, quite well dressed. Certainly no elaborate beards or no hats and whatever this week's completely unique look is. But yeah, it's things like that that you actually do see a lot, and always did see at the Globe, I think. I mean, even a couple of months ago when they did The Tempest and Dominic Rowan came back, where he was essentially reprising his Touchstone from As You Like It a few years back, who was just all kind of ad-libs and breaking away from the script. And I think there's a real history of that here. And I think it's just because it's a bit more blatant that it's being picked out. But I thought all of that really worked. I'm not entirely convinced by the gender swap of Helena. The reason being, even when it's done as two men and two women, I think there's a risk that at the end of the play, you basically have Demetrius going off and spending the rest of his life with someone who he's been magically made to love. He's kind of going to go off and spend the rest of his life under a love spell and not necessarily his own free will. So I think there is obviously a risk of, if you're going to gender flip it, of making it seem like he's kind of been magically turned gay. And I've read interviews with Emma Rice and Dan Cabal where they've said they're very aware of this and wanted to, you know, make it very clear that Demetrius was just lying to himself and, you know, did really love Helenus. But I just don't think that came across in performance, unfortunately. I thought he looked like he just wasn't interested and ended up being magically put together with somebody he had a one-night stand with, and, you know, that's it. That's who you're going to spend the rest of your life with. So I think the theory of it is good, but I think you needed to be incredibly careful with how you presented that relationship, and I don't think it came across in the way that they were hoping for. The other kind of big bit of gender swapping is that all the Rude Mechanicals except for Bottom are women now. And the conceit here is kind of that they're all Globe stewards who've kind of decided to do the Amdram bit for the wedding. So they get kind of a little introduction at the top of the show. They do the announcements about turning your phones off. So they get a little comedy scene in that. I don't know whether people were fooled that they were real stewards, but, you know, they do turn up later as the Mechanicals. that I thought worked really well, because it, you've got a younger and fitter Bottom than usual. It's Ewan Wardrop, who's formerly maybe one of Matthew Bourne's dancers. And he's funny and blustering in the way that Bottom kind of generally is. But also it kind of makes for a fun, different dynamic with the all-female mechanicals who he kind of flirts with. I think if this was being presented as, you know, this is what we're doing, this is how the globe's going to be now, then I think people maybe would have reason to be worried. But I don't think it is being presented that way. I think it's kind of, well, we want to try things, and here's us trying a lot of things at once, and not all of it is going to work. But I think enough of it works that, you know, there was a lot of people clearly having a really good time, and a lot of kind of young kids in the Groundlings who I could see who were loving it. And that's always an encouraging thing in Shakespeare, when you see that a production is getting kids in early with something they're going to love and want to revisit. And there's nothing worse than seeing school parties at something like the Old Vic Much Ado a few years ago, where you think, well, that's the last time they voluntarily go to Shakespeare in their lives. So I think essentially I'd neither go with the people who go, well, this is an absolute triumph and, you know, this is the best thing since sliced bread, but also I don't think it's a disaster by any means. I think it's an experiment, and I think it's in many ways a successful one, just not in every single way, which is fair enough, to be honest.
Yeah, I found it fairly typical knee-high in some ways. I mean, at least everybody gets down to the sort of the vest and tighty-whities that you see in an awful lot of knee-high plays, and you get quite a lot of underwear on display in this play. As an introduction to Emma Rice taking over, I think it's a rather interesting one, and, well, at least it's going to be interesting to see how it develops from here on out, because I can forgive it quite a lot, you know, because she has only done that very cut-down Cymbeline, which I think I saw a few years back. So she's fairly new, not only to the theatre, she's also new to doing Shakespeare more full-time. So I'm going to put up with an awful lot of what she does, you know, if I think there are slight mistakes. I too didn't really like the miking, and the lighting wasn't too bad, but I just found it a little bit fussy and a little bit alien. It's almost as if she didn't want to be in this particular theatre. But I think those things are, once she gets used to the space and using the space, then it's going to hopefully get better. And it is a bit of a change from the Dominic Drumgoole ones. I mean, I think they suffered in the end from being a little bit too heritage, you know. It was always of a good standard, but it was always original practices. It was, you know, almost always original practices, and very few people were taking real risks with the way that you were doing the plays. I mean, there were relatively few, certainly in the outdoor season, for Dominic Drumgoole. So we're going to get a few more risks, a few more distinct settings and characterizations. I didn't really get the whole Hoxton stuff. I mean, you certainly needed people in peculiar beards with hair that stood up a little bit in order to really get me feeling it was Hoxton hipsterish. They're not quite such a bad offender as I've seen it at others, but I am very much against these people who do the what I think of as one-line Shakespeare. You know, you turn Hamlet's Denmark into a police state because of the line, "There is something rotten in the state of Denmark," which I think is wrong. And in this, as with ever, there is a line very early in the play which says, "Hippolyte, I wooed thee with my sword, and won thy love doing the injuries," to which people will do things like pretend that she's been raped, or it's a physical incarceration, she's some kind of slave coming to it, when there are other interpretations, you know, whether they are sexual or fun, you know, people just fighting and falling in love. It's a fairly common trope, but they didn't really do that here. In this one, Theseus is a bit of a Russian oligarch, and Hippolyta is his drunken floozy, essentially. If you try to make them not like each other to start off with, none of the rest of Theseus and Hippolyta's lines make any sense, and it's always a problem for me, and it's something that depresses me very early in the play, because that line comes in so early, and if you know how they're interpreting it, you know that they've made a mistake, or at least I think they've made a mistake, and I have a problem with that. And, you know, I therefore have a problem with the rest of the play going on, which is a problem for me rather than a problem for the play. And, you know, you have to understand that the people playing Theseus and Hippolyta, even if they're doubling with Oberon and Titania, which is that they are here, the rest of Theseus and Hippolyta's lines are actually rather dull, and this is the only thing that they can get their teeth into. But the point is that if they've got their teeth into that, then the dull bits don't make any sense. But the rest of it, as I said, it felt very typical of a knee-high show. It was very entertaining. I had the same problems as I think I said with the mics as you, voices coming in from the wrong place. So it did feel a little bit un-Globe-like and a little bit wrong for the Globe. But I think that it's a first go, and it's very fine for all that. And it's not the greatest play I've ever seen. It's certainly not the greatest play I've ever seen at the Globe, but it was a good try. And, you know, lots of fun things in there and lots of very interesting takes on the play. And I was, I think, entertained throughout, even if I was a bit annoyed by a couple of lines. But I studied this play years and years ago, and I can quote lines almost by heart in some cases. So, you know, I feel ownership over it, although, you know, obviously nobody owns Shakespeare, but there is a little bit of that for me. No, I think I like this play, and I did enjoy my time there. And I definitely want to see, you know, what she's going to do next and how she's going to tackle Shakespeare in the future. And it's going to be interesting, certainly.
Well, you'll have to wait, though, because this is the only Shakespeare she's doing in the whole first year, personally, because they've announced, obviously, the Swanomaker season. And there's an Othello in there, which is the only Shakespeare they're doing, which I'm in favour of, because I like that the Swanomaker is mostly not Shakespeare, but she's not directing that. So actually it means that she won't be doing another Shakespeare play until next year. Maybe it's quite a wise decision. Maybe it's kind of, you know, sitting back and getting to learn how the space works and how the texts work and knowing what you're doing. It might be a good idea. On the thesis doesn't have to be a bastard area. I do kind of wish someone would at some point acknowledge that he does go kind of, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, well, we're definitely going to have Hermia killed off if she doesn't do what she wants. So I'm just going to leave you here, Hermia, with Lysander. I'm just going to take your dad out to have a conversation just somewhere else and just leave you two here for whatever reason. And, you know, nobody kind of ever sees that as him trying to help them escape. Kind of, okay, you go and I'm going to get your dad out of the way so you can sort something out. So there's definitely, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with going dark with Theseus. And I haven't watched the TV version yet, the Russell T. Davis one. But I know already from that if you haven't seen that one yet, I know you're not going to like it, because they go incredibly dark with Theseus this time. But, you know, I think it's perfectly valid, but it does seem to be the standard way of doing Theseus now, which is a bit of a shame that, you know, there's other angles that could be looked at.
We're now going to talk about The Suicide at the Littleton Theatre. This is a version of a play by Nikolai Erdmann made in 1928, for which he got into a lot of trouble with the Russians. The idea is that a man decides he wants to commit suicide and then tells everybody about it, and people try to use him in some ways, whether it is an ex-girlfriend, his mother-in-law, various kinds of reporters, do-gooders, and politicians try to get involved, either to take credit for his suicide or to in some way prevent it. But most of them want to enable them to blame other people for the man's suicide, and he's just in complete despair, really. This version has been written by Suhailia El Bushra and is set in contemporary urban Britain, probably in part of London. It stars Javon Prince as the man who wants to commit suicide. He is accompanied by the likes of Ayesha Antoine, Paul Kay, Ashley Maguire, Lisa Simpson, Pookie Questnell, and Rebecca Scroggs. I can't name absolutely everybody, because although I've got a cast list in front of me, I can't remember what parts they played. It's been quite a while since I saw this play. This subject has been dealt with before, well, about 10 years ago, 9 years ago. They did a correctly set version, set in the 1920s version in Russia, of the play. They called it Dying for It, and it was written by Moira Buffini and directed by Anna McMinn, and had an interesting cast, which included people like Tom Brooke and Michelle Dockery, Barnaby Kay, Liz White, Sophie Stanton, Ronan Vibert, and Paul Ryder, amongst others. I could spend all my time naming actors. But this version at the Littleton Theatre is much more contemporary, much more buzzy, and takes a lot of pot shots at people that you might feel are recognisable, certainly recognisable in an urban setting. The original is based in a sort of tenement where this man decides to end it all and wants to kill himself. Julie, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
When I saw the title, I thought, oh, it could be something that is quite bleak, because that weekend when I saw Suicide, I also saw Blue Orange and Book as well. So it was quite a weekend. But actually, Suicide was quite uplifting, even though the subject matter does feel very bleak, and it is a serious issue, obviously, suicide. But what this play was really a farce that kind of not took the mickey, but played with stereotypes. And it was actually about the good in people. That's what I felt. So we had this central character, Sam, who'd lost his job, and then he couldn't sign on because he'd stopped to help a neighbour. And actually, it was always because he was a good man inside that all these bad things were happening to him, and he was starting to despair. But him and his wife, it was about their relationship, and you could see there was a real love there. I thought there were some outstanding performances, Javone Prince playing Sam, Rebecca Scroggs playing Maya, and Ashley McGuire playing the mother-in-law. I thought she was absolutely brilliant and really funny. But also the mother-in-law, again, with lots of good in her. And all these people that were hanging on that you were talking about before, so a politician, social services, a camera crew, a yuppie trying to make good. They were kind of horrible characters and very kind of one-dimensional. But I don't think that really mattered, because the play was sending these people up. So it was actually a really funny play. I didn't think, well, this is a major spoiler, but I didn't actually think Sam would go through with the suicide. I think always there was a real sense of hope. I don't know what you thought, Tim.
I sort of enjoyed this. I thought it was a bit scrappy in places. As you say, the hangers-on and the people who get involved, they're not particularly likeable, although that central threesome of Javone Prince, Rebecca Scroggs and Ashley McGuire, they were a very tight unit and very likeable. And there were a couple of fairly likeable friends that he had, although one or two of them took too much advantage, I think. But, I mean, that is a whole thing. Everybody's sort of out for themselves in the end, and they don't really care about other people. But, I mean, there were bits of it which were scrappy, and when it's difficult to like people, it's difficult to really care what they're doing or what they're saying. So I did have a few problems there. But overall, it is a good production. It's a pity we haven't got closer to the time to do this, and we've had to wait quite a long time to review this, because I think it's certainly worth a look. I did mention the one I saw 9 years ago, and I thought that was better. This is a bit too, I think, because it's trying to be up to date. It's one of these things where nothing dates like trying to be really up to date. You're nailing a whole load of things which won't be current, probably not even current next year, let alone in 10 years' time. So the other one lives better in my memory, because it was set in 1928, so you'd feel that all that, the power that you can get from doing everything in hindsight, that allows that. And this one, being very contemporary, you can kind of see that it's going to flag and it's going to look rather odd if they do it again in 4 or 5 years. It might not last that long, which is it's a bit of a pity, and it's a bit of a pity being aware of that while you're watching it, and I think I was. But it does have some interesting people in it. I would like to put in a word for Lisa Jackson, who's a bit of a favourite actress for me, and she plays this do-gooding yuppie who's running a cafe of some description and thinking about helping but really wanting to make money just like anybody else. That's a nice little part, but there are so many great little bits in this which are enormous fun to watch. And like I said, the only downers are that, yeah, sometimes it's a bit scrappy. Although I like Javone Prince, he needed to be more than he was being given. He needed to be a bigger character, and I didn't think he was really interesting enough in himself. It wasn't that it's bad acting, it's just that it didn't really feel big acting. You know, he's obviously all over the posters and everybody's making it about him, but I don't think he didn't really live up to that bigness and that title role, which is something of a pity. But overall, as I said, it's a good production. It's not actually, and it's certainly not actually that he was bad. It's just that somehow you needed somebody a lot bigger than him. And I'm not sure He's a bit of a mystery. He certainly had his own TV series and things like that, so you might think he is very famous, but you do kind of need a big performance in there, and I don't know that he gave a big enough performance. He just gave a good performance, and that was a bit of a shame. But I keep saying it's a good production, and fun was had, I think.
Interesting what you're saying about Sam, Jerome Prince. I think for me it was very much in that Farce tradition, and you don't really get a lot of depth in that central character in those kind of things. It tends to be they're the catalyst for everybody getting mixed up and running around the set, which ended up happening here. But I do think you make a really good point that I hadn't really thought about bringing it right up to date, because there was a lot of focus on the social networking and filming on mobile phones, and once something was out there you couldn't bring it back. And actually that is very, very dated, and there's been a lot done around that. But I suppose that's an interesting take, isn't it, that, you know, as soon as you say something or you film it, it's gone viral, you've got all these hits. So about in this world you can be famous on YouTube, and the guy who becomes the pop star, that a similar thing happening to him. So that's quite individualistic as well. I don't know if you got that from the original production, the one that you saw at the Almeida, that kind of focus on the individual.
Well, I mean, certainly everybody in the Almeida production was selfish, but of course in 1928 there isn't quite that ability to become famous. I think somebody does sort of become famous by writing a poem, stuff like that, you know, it's poems rather than singers in those days that are regarded as important, poets rather than songwriters. So I think that's how that one works. But it's a different take on the same basic play, so it was very much different. But it did, as I said, it lives in my memory better, that production, rather than this one. This one, as I say, good, but yeah, there's the contemporary stuff is always a little bit worrying.
Yeah.
Because it makes it fleeting. If you're put it up to date, it's going to be out of date very quickly, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it's not really any worse for that, and you need plays that express how things are right now, even if you don't quite understand them in a few years' time. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page and Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.